You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 6th to the 12th of March. My name is John Elms, filling in for our regular host Chris Parr, who has been busy putting together a special podcast for THE's latest world reputation rankings, which is available now. I thoroughly recommend having a listen to that online. I am joined today by books editor Karen Shook, news editor Simon Baker, and reporter Jack Grove. And in the news this week, sector figures have warned that universities may need to cut their spending per student next year because teaching funds will have to cover 30,000 extra students. We'll be hearing more on that from Jack in a bit. Elsewhere, a psychologist from Durham University has said too many students are being diagnosed as dyslexic, with the overall number registered as having the condition rising 40% in 5 years. Simon and Jack will run us through that one a little bit later. And Karen, our books editor, as I said, will be giving us the lowdown on this week's book section, featuring works on all manner of topics, including our book of the week, Why Work Became So Bad for So Many and What Can Be Done to Improve It. Something we could probably all do with reading, I imagine. But first, the news that teaching funds are going to be stretched because of extra students. Jack, could you tell us more about your splash?
This story concerns the grant letter that was published last month. And the amount available to the sector was made clear in that, and institutions will be getting their allocations in the next few weeks. And although the sector was quite pleased about the fact that they didn't suffer cuts that were predicted to be particularly bad, there is a new danger that we've sort of been exploring, which is the fact that existing funds that are allocated by HEFCE, the Higher Education Funding Council for England, are going to have to be stretched further than ever because there'll be 30,000 extra students in the system. So those extra funds that pay for high-cost students, those doing medicine, engineering, things that cost more than the £9,000 fee, and also students who cost more to educate, students from poorer backgrounds who need extra support. There's a limited amount of funding, and lots of these students coming into the system will be calling on that funding. And as a result, the per student allocation will be reduced, says David Maguire, Vice Chancellor of the University of Greenwich, which is has many students from widening participation backgrounds. And this is backed up by Andy Westwood as well, Chief Executive of Guild HE, which represents a group of universities. And so there's basically a lot of concern about this extra 30,000 students coming into the system. Another concern is there's 30,000 extra student places being funded, but will universities that expanded quite rapidly last year by 7% on average, will they be able to expand again to fill all these places? So we're looking at some of the concerns around this much heralded announcement by George Osborne back in December and what it will mean for the sector.
Yes, because David Maguire used the word eroded, which is quite a strong word to say about the units of resource that the teaching funds there.
Exactly. I think this is really important because the whole rationale for the £9,000 fees was that the unit of resource was to be protected, and this is something that has been David Willetts has been hugely proud about this, and there's concerns that the unit of resource is being eroded by these extra students coming into the system, but also inflation, because over the between 2012, when the fees came in, and 2016, when the fee cap will probably next be reviewed, it will have stayed at exactly £9,000 a year, and so inflation will have nibbled away at it. So,
yeah,
in a sense, the unit of resource will be diminished in that way.
I mean, I think that inflation point's really quite important, and it's a sort of slow-burning issue, really, in higher education over the last couple of years. People mention it now and again. Vice-chancellors have raised it. Look, you know, the cap's not gone up with inflation as it did before, you know, 2012 when fees were around £3,000. They always went up with inflation. I mean, gradually, it's been, you know, the value of that £9,000 has been eroded. It's probably in real terms much more like £8,000 now in sort of 2012 prices. You know, that's not something that politically is going to sort of wash with many people. If you start talking about, yeah, we're putting the fee cap up a bit more about inflation, most members of the public are going to go, well, you know, you've already put it up to £9,000 for our children, yeah. So, you know, we don't want it going up anymore. So it's quite politically an easy thing to do to hold it at £9,000 every year. It doesn't cause any waves. Well, for the voting public, anyway.
Not for the voting public, for academics who
are held to a 1% pay rise.
This lack of inflation proofing is quite significant.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the potential repercussions of this? I mean, we're hypothesising now, but when the fees cap, the student numbers cap came off, there was some rumbling in the sector about, you know, some universities who do start to recruit more on top of the already recruitment, quality might go down in some courses. Is this a real fear in the sector?
I think David Maguire from Greenwich is quite clear to point out that. You know, he's worried about whether, you know, he'd be able to recruit more students because they've raised their entry standards on average. And so he's not sure where, you know, there comes a point where you only got so many students with certain A levels. But, you know, there will be a suggestion that other institutions out there will recruit more people with BTECs maybe or A levels with less with lower grades, and you know that is the fear generally. I mean, I think the UCAS report last year on admissions showed that the average entry tariff had fallen really for a lot.
It has. That, I mean, that is an issue. These extra students coming to the system are not going to be as academically equipped as the people in the system, and what will that mean for British universities that generally try and keep their entry grades quite high.
Well, as we say, this is on page 6 of our magazine. Here's our splash. Go check it out and have a read through all the quotes and comments. There are obviously a number of real concerns for the sector on this news. Staying with the news, the new master of Collingwood College, Professor Julian Elliott at Durham University, believes that too many students with mild literacy problems are being wrongly diagnosed with dyslexia. Simon, you took particularly interest in this story. What is he?
Yeah, and this is a story that we've covered with an opinion piece as well this week from Julian Elliott, and he's not just looked at higher education. I mean, he's got a new book that looks at dyslexia and questions whether it's just become a catch-all term for all sorts of different problems. I mean, I suppose he's not saying that people with other problems shouldn't be helped, saying they should be supported as well. It's just that lots of people are being labelled as dyslexic when it's the wrong term. He's specifically in this story kind of pointed to figures in higher education that show the number of students that are registered as having a condition has sort of risen 40% in the last 5 years. Experts, and we've got somebody quoted from Dyslexia Charity, Dyslexia Action, sort of pointing out that diagnosis is better with this has always been a problem that a lot of people have suffered from, and we're just getting better at recognising it. So it's just opened an interesting debate, really, about dyslexia and whether, you know, it really is the right term for some other issues that may revolve around learning difficulties in other areas and not specific, you know, the specific problem of decoding text.
Yeah. And it has implications for universities, obviously, because they're under the Equality Act, reasonable adjustments need to be made, and there's a clear advantage to a student to being diagnosed as dyslexic as opposed to something else because of the funding that's available through Student Finance England that can cover things all the way up to a laptop to the tune of over £5,000. So there's clearly a concern there about whether that is privileging some students over others who don't have a diagnosis of dyslexia, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, there is a danger that you don't want to play too much into the kind of... there will be some that probably have the opinion, and I don't think that's the point being made here at all, that, you know, some students are being dyslexia is just kind of a made up condition, and all this is doing is just being applied to people that aren't academically gifted and they're just not bright enough, you know. Mm. And you know, the danger is that you can go too far the other way and just say, yeah, all these students just aren't bright enough, really, that's their problem. You know, there clearly is a, you know, is a recognised condition. It's just whether is it being applied to too many other sort of problems, mm. really.
And yeah. his concern is that the diagnosis is so subjective in his view, in that there isn't scientific rigour, so there is not an accepted test that determines it.
I mean, it's always seemed to me to be a slightly, well, I'm not an expert at all by any means on dyslexia, but it does seem to me that it's always been a kind of scientifically, you know, not a completely proven area where you just, you know, there doesn't seem to be an objective test really for it. And so, you know, and
he points to the role of privately hired assessors, where as a student you can go and pay someone £300 to £600 to be assessed, and there may be some feeling on the part of the person who's getting the £600 to come back and say you have at least mild dyslexia.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Well, as we say, that story is on page 12, and Professor Elliott, as Simon mentioned, has written an opinion piece on page 34 of our magazine. Karen, books. Give us the lowdown. What's happening on the HE academic literature world?
In our weekly What Are You Reading column, for those of you, if there's anyone still out there in the academy who hasn't read Stoner by John Williams, the great lost novel, first published in 1965, about a humanities scholar and his trials and tribulations and indeed his death, but a restatement of the value of the humanities. If anyone hasn't heard about that book, Lawrence Koop mentions it in What Are You Reading This Week, and it's certainly worth a read, as the millions of copies sold worldwide would attest. Who could have thought that a third-rate academic in an obscure Midwestern college could become the fictional hero of so many? This week's book of the week is The Fissured Workplace by David Weil. David Weil is an incredibly eminent American scholar who specializes in employment and labor policy. He's professor of management at Boston University, and some of the time he's at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. It's just a crosstown visit. He also resisted the idea predicted by his grandmother that he would grow up to be a professor. He thought it was the last thing he wanted to do. Now he is one. He is also Barack Obama's nominee to head the wage and hour division at the Department of Labor, which is a politically very contentious post and has remained unfilled for a couple of years because the Republicans felt that obviously anyone who was worried about whether people were getting paid the minimum wage might be a bit suspicious. His record, I think a lot of people in the academy would say, proves that his approach is quite rigorous and not ideologically driven. So we'll see whether the Senate ratifies that post. But certainly if you're looking to see impact, an academic being at the head of the wage and hour division in the Department of Labor is pretty good. Our reviewer, Virginia Dolgast at the London School of Economics, looks at his view of a workplace in which increasingly companies are devolving responsibility for their workers to complex networks of suppliers and franchisees, outsourcing, in other words, deniability. And his argument is that essentially the companies to whom the work is outsourced can only be doing so by attacking the pay and conditions of the people who are carrying out the work, and that this is spreading from people who clean hotels all the way up to law and the media. And I think people who read our pages will think of perhaps points of comparison with outsourcing of support staff at universities.
Yeah.
Also this week, Tara Brabazon, our preeminent commentator on new media, takes on a book called The App Generation, How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. She doesn't think much of this book. It is a oh dear, what about the digital generation book masquerading as an app book, and focuses rather strangely on the idea that age and use of technology are allied. And she points out that her 85-year-old father uses an iPhone 5 with no ill effects. Also this week, Annabelle Tremlett from the University of Portsmouth reviews Yaron Matras's book, which has been much covered in the broadsheets, I Meet Lucky People, the story of the Romani gypsies. His viewpoint comes from a linguistic background. She argues perhaps that the book has too much of a division between us and them, and it presupposes a readership who are not themselves ROM. And finally, Malcolm Gillies, Vice Chancellor of London Metropolitan University, has been lured back into our pages to review a book called How Universities Work. This is written by John Lombardi, who is a former president of a number of American institutions. And Malcolm muses on the fact that deans lose their faculties, departments lose their heads. But what happens when presidents stop presiding? Well, in many cases, they write a book saying how universities should be run. And Malcolm gives us his view on that.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, that was a comprehensive rundown of what we have in our book section. If you want to check out more, that's from pages 50 to 54.
There's always more, John.
There's always more, absolutely. I particularly like Clive Bloom's review of Aleister Crowley and the Temptation of Politics.
Who knew he was a political figure?
Who knew he was a political figure? Everyone just thought he was an occultist and a magician, didn't they? Anyway, intriguing subject matter. Besides our wealth of news and books content, we also have a cracking feature section, I should point out this week, leading off with our cover story, which is a 10-point guide on getting your first scholarly monograph published. We've recruited an expert panel of HE heavyweights to give you their tips.
Many of my books pages styles, I have to say.
I think, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, they cross over into many different aspects of our magazine, and they've given their tips, and they've all had many books published, one of whom, 160 I read. It's quite a lot of academic work there. Elsewhere, our reporter Holly Else has been sifting through numbers to see if claims of a serious shortage of STEM graduates have been exaggerated. Some observers seem to think so, and some interesting arguments in that piece. But that's it for this week's issue review. If you want to comment on any of the content in the magazine, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course you can comment on our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. But until next week, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.